You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. It looks like we're headed for a different and a difficult climate, unless humans can reverse our pollution by grabbing greenhouse gases right out of the sky. Recently on Radio EcoShock, Dr. Kevin Anderson explained the hazards of counting on carbon capture and storage as we continue to pollute the atmosphere. His paper was published in the journal Science in October 2016. On November 11th, Science published a reply with a more positive view of carbon capture. The author is Dr. Klaus S. Lackner. He's the director of the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions and a professor at Arizona State University. Lackner got his doctorate at physics at Germany's Heidelberg University. He started in atomic work, including a period at Los Alamos National Lab. Then Klaus branched into climate research, including contributing to a report on carbon capture and storage for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Klaus Lackner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Dr. Lackner, why did you write a reply to the paper, The Trouble with Negative Emissions, by Anderson and Peters?
Well, first of all, it wasn't just me. That is the way it came out in Science, because we had 45 authors, and they relegated the majority to the supplement because they couldn't make room enough in the main pages for such a long list of authors. So it wasn't just me, but I was the one who started it. But then we had a large group of people who not only signed up, but helped with the editing and replying to this perspective in Science.
Why did you feel a reply was necessary?
I think the reply is necessary because the way it came across in the perspective, it was not so much that we shouldn't just count on negative emissions. I'm the first person to agree that we shouldn't count on the ability to do this until we actually have done it. But it sort of relegated it as a unjust and high-risk gamble, and thereby sort of implied that we should try to solve the problem just without it. And I don't think that is actually feasible anymore. I actually think we're in a position right now where we most likely will overshoot even if we put in best possible efforts. But we may find that even negative emissions cannot solve the problem anymore. But keeping that half of the response out of the mix is probably an equally risky proposition. In effect, we are already past this point, and even the paper makes it quite clear. It points out that we are currently at 404 parts per million and going up by two and a half parts per million a year. And if we want to stop at 450 parts per million, we probably cannot do this anymore.
Your article is titled The Promise of Negative Emissions. Let's talk about that in detail. First, please tell us what the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions does.
Well, I started from the perspective that we probably will need negative emissions to balance the carbon budget. So my view of it is, in a way, quite simple. We should think of carbon dioxide we are producing in the consumption of fossil fuels as a waste product we just dump into the atmosphere. And we have by now figured out that we are not allowed to dump it there. And thinking about it as a waste problem rather than a pollution problem actually changes the way you think about it. And I can give you a simple example. If I were to dump my garbage in the street, my neighbors would be very unhappy with me and probably call the cops on me. And they wouldn't take it for an answer that I said, but I thought about it very hard and I made it a lot better by reducing my garbage production and conserving where I can. And this year, it's actually 20% less than last year. But in the climate change debate, we do exactly that. We actually set targets how much we want to reduce this year, where really we have to take the point of view, this is garbage. It's dumped into the atmosphere, and we have to stop doing this. And we may have to take some of it back because we already put so much out that we are over the limit we can possibly afford being out there. So that's where our starting point was. And if you look at the IPCC, you can say that the modelers just willy-nilly invented technologies to have negative emissions. But the other way of looking at is that the modelers were unable to balance the carbon budget in time without having such negative emissions. So to me, it's not so much a question of will the negative emissions work, but what can we do to make them work?
Do you think, though, that the Paris Climate Agreement, which begins with such low demands for reducing national emissions, could they do that if they didn't assume carbon capture technology in the future?
Well, they are starting to put some ambition behind what we should do, and they are asking people to make promises. And if you add up all the promises, it falls woefully short from what needs to be done. Paris, on the other side, is very ambitious. Paris says we have to hold the line below 2 degree warming, and they then turn around and say we should actually stop at 1.5 degree warming. I would make the argument we probably are already at 1.5 degree warming. And the way I mean this is not that we right now have reached 1.5 degree warming, but if we could, by some technology, hold the CO2 level in the atmosphere at about 400 parts per million, it will still get warmer for decades and decades to come because the climate hasn't yet equilibrated to 400 ppm. The oceans still act as a cool spot in the system. We have sort of ice cubes in the glass, and it hasn't warmed up yet, right? So as a consequence, it is not at all clear that if we waited 50, 60 years at 400 parts per million, that we haven't effectively already breached the 1.5 ppm. Therefore, if we want to stay below it, we really will have to pull CO2 back. If the agreement is 2 degree warming is where we should hold the line, then we probably end up around 450 parts per million. Now, at the current rate of emission, that will take us about 16 years.
I understand. Well, now, could you explain for us one of the technologies that people seem to favor, BECCS, the bioenergy with carbon capture and storage idea?
Well, you now are looking for negative emissions, right? And one where we actually know how to do it is BECCS, right? If your power plant were to burn wood rather than coal, and you still collect the CO2 in the flue stack, and you still bury that CO2, then you have created a negative emission, right? What's nice about this particular technology is there is not all that much new that needs to be invented. What's problematic with this technology is that if you wanted to do it at the scale you need to do it, you probably would need more land assigned to BECCS than we currently assign to agriculture. So I don't think by itself it will ever get big enough. It can help. There's not a single solution to the problem. It's sort of one arrow in the quiver. But we need additional options. So we are working on technology and technological means of pulling CO2 back out of the atmosphere. In other words, we are looking at sorbents which bind CO2, and then we can take the CO2 back off the sorbent and keep doing the cycle, so we collect CO2 by that means.
Well, would we have pools of that solvent or something? How would that work?
In our particular case, actually, with one exception, the people who are doing this use solid materials. So in our case, it's a plastic-like material that when it's dry has a very high affinity to CO2, and when you make it wet, it gives it back. So the picture is it's like a tree, we call it a synthetic tree that stands out in the wind, and the leaves of that tree bind CO2 as the wind moves over it, and then ever so often, roughly every an hour, we collect those into a closed box, make it wet, and harvest the CO2 that comes off, process it further on in order to make pure compressed CO2, and then the wet leaves go back into the outside, they dry in the wind, and pick up CO2 again. So that's how you could imagine to do this, and this particular technology and most of the air capture devices are about 1,000 times faster than a tree. The tree is not specialized to collect CO2. It does it because it needs to, but it does many other things.
Do we have the technology right now to capture carbon from smokestacks of power plants?
Yes, we do. We have had this for a long time because we used it for other purposes. We never built it out to a scale where it deals with the CO2 from power plants. But that's just half of the story, right? You fly in an airplane and you drive a car and you move freight over the oceans by ship. All of these things emit CO2. As a matter of fact, the hardest part of the equation to solve is the CO2 which is generated from liquid fuels, right, in the transportation sector. And we cannot leave that out. In other words, we cannot solve the carbon dioxide problem by removing 90% of the CO2 from flue stacks, which make up maybe a third of the total.
Well, supposing we do get it from the flue stacks or we collect it in these trees that you've described, how do we store it?
I don't think at this point we have a choice anymore. It's a simple mass balance. As long as we dig up carbon from the ground, we will have to put it back, right? And it is quite likely that we already overshot. And even if you do the best you can possibly do, you nearly certainly have overshot. And so very likely we will have to take 100 ppm of CO2, which are in the air, get it back and put it somewhere. Right. So from that perspective, we have no choice. Now, there are multiple options. The currently most favored option, because it's relatively low in cost, is to inject it into underground saline aquifers and keep it there. Right. That has a certain amount of capacity. Whether it has enough can be argued. I had started in 1995 to say we should really do what I would call accelerated geological weathering. If you look at certain rocks, they will react with the CO2 in the air, which in rain comes down as carbonic acid, and make salts, namely carbonates. And if we wait about 100,000 years, that's how the problem we created right now will go away. Right? But the question is, can we do this faster and make mineral carbonates at the scale we need to do? And for example, there is a project in Iceland where people are putting CO2 underground and show that the Icelandic basalts actually form carbonates in less than 2 years. So there are ways of storing carbon dioxide. Unless we are comfortable to live well above 450 parts per million, I think we already have removed the option not to deal with it. And so I don't view carbon sequestration as an excuse to keep on using fossil fuels. I view it as something we probably already have to do in order to balance the books. If 350.org is right or James Hansen is right, and we should not exceed 350 ppm in the air in the long run, we will not get back to 350 ppm in a very, very long time, unless we actively remove carbon dioxide from the air and store it somewhere.
Well, that somewhere can be a problem. I mean, we just saw the deep storage well for natural gas blow out at Aliso Canyon in California. They couldn't stop it for 4 months. What happens if a carbon storage facility leaks out the carbon we thought was safely stored down there?
Then you are right back where you were if you had ignored the problem, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Let me add on this a little. If you can pull CO2 back out of the air, you can actually get it back. Unlike the methane, which comes out of that well, the CO2, unless it's really coming out in vast, vast quantities at one spot, is actually not hazardous, right? It goes into the air and it creates exactly the climate change it would have created if you had let it out in the first place. But if you say, I happen to have just lost 1 million tons of CO2, then in a way you are on the hook to collect another 1 million tons of CO2 and put it back, which is another reason why air capture is so important, right? Because it makes it possible to undo the damage you did. And I think one of the reasons which makes it so hard to move forward, and this is another point where I disagree with Anderson, what makes it so hard to move forward, if I am an emitter and I emit it and you complain, I'm going to shrug my shoulders and say, what are you going to do about it? Right? But if you have the ability to create negative emissions, you can go back and say, well, I pulled it back and you are liable for doing this. You are going to pay for this change. You'd be surprised how fast people will figure out that they are better off to not let the CO2 out in the first place than having to pay for pulling it back later. In other words, I don't see negative emissions necessarily as a way of delaying things. It certainly will have that effect, but it also will accelerate action by making it possible to hold you liable and actually force action which undoes what you just did. right? And that is new once you have negative emissions. If you have air capture, I give you a simple example. Right now, most of the coal industry says, we understand there is climate change, and we are researching to find solutions, but it's so expensive you don't want to do it. And by the way, you need our cooperation. As long as we tell you it's too expensive, nothing will happen. But if you can tell the coal company or the utility which burns coal, okay, that's fine, but then you have to pay for the air capture, which will reverse the CO2 emissions, you'd be surprised how fast they figure out that they can be faster. Right? Air capture shouldn't be for coal plants. It should be for airplanes, where you really have a very hard time coming up with another option. But if coal plants do not cooperate, you can always force them to solve the problem this way.
Radio EcoShock.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is a distinguished scientist and a leader in the hunt for a way to prevent the worst of climate change. He's Dr. Klaus Lackner from the Arizona State University. You raised a point just now that kind of stimulated me. You said, well, we can go back. And my reading from the scientists I've talked to is likely we can't go back in any ecological way. So many changes have already been put into motion, but at least we could stop the worst from happening. Now, what do you think about that?
I would 100% agree with what you just said, right? And therefore, I always say the ability to have negative emissions, the ability to have air capture is not an excuse to do nothing. Because as we go forward, we create irreversible damages, right? The fact that we come back down in CO2 will not unmelt the glaciers. Once they are molten, once the glaciers have gone away, it'll take a long, long time for them to come back. So yes, you have irreversible damage. But if your choice is to end up at 500 ppm and stay there, or touch on 500 ppm and come back to 350, which of the two do you think is better?
Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about other technologies that have been advanced. France is proposing changes to agriculture to put more carbon in the soil. It's called the 4 per 1,000 project. What are your thoughts on that as a solution?
I think there are many, many different ways of putting carbon away. And what we need is accounting schemes and metrics which clearly define that we have done that. So what I would like is a certificate of sequestration, or if you prefer, a certificate of negative emissions, which can show you that it has been put away. Then many different things can play. And I would argue BECCS, as well as hiding carbon in agricultural fields, can be a good contributor. I am doubtful that it can reach the necessary scale. We are putting 36 billion tons of CO2 out a year, and I don't think you can come close to that. And in a way, we have worried about deforestation as being a contributor to climate change, but it's a small contributor to climate change. Fossil fuels are the big one, and so doing the opposite will be helpful, but it will not solve the problem.
I'm told Bill Gates is funding research into carbon capture. What do you know about that?
Well, there's a group in Canada Bill Gates has funded, and they are doing very good work. So that's carbon engineering.
And is the U.S. government funding negative emissions research, or would you expect that support to continue under the Trump administration?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it's early days. I would hope so. But, I mean, the statements which have been made in the past don't sound encouraging.
Is carbon capture research going ahead well in other countries?
I think the negative emission research is just at the cusp, and it's just starting, and it's not very well positioned. And this is a part of the reason why we had such a large response by so many people to the Kevin Anderson paper, because you get in trouble with both sides, right? If you think climate change is a hoax, why in the world would you want negative emissions, right? And if on the other side, people who say you need to do the purest thing and stop all fossil fuel consumption overnight, and you need to change your lifestyle, and that's the only way to solve the problem, and negative emissions give you an excuse not to do that, therefore it shouldn't be done, you are caught in the middle. The problem is we have had by now 20 years to implement mitigation without negative emissions, and we have done practically nothing, right? And in 1980, we could have had a very good discussion about whether we should or should not have negative emissions because it might delay implementation. But by now, we are so far down the road that I don't think we can make it happen without negative emissions.
I think there's a communications problem, too, because people seem to be nervous about using a technology to solve the problems of technology. How can we solve that?
Well, the alternative is not to use technology. And people seem to take energy so much for granted that they don't realize that they rely on it every day. We wouldn't be able to feed people unless we had the amount of energy we had. Which is not to say that on occasion we don't waste it, right? But we have fertilizer, and without fertilizer, we couldn't feed 7 billion people. And guess what? When we make fertilizer, we first make hydrogen to make ammonia. And making that hydrogen took energy. And if you want clean water, you have to clean up water, and that requires energy. If you want raw materials, you need energy. If you want to fly from New York to Los Angeles, you need energy. If you want to have a radio system, you are consuming energy. We are consuming energy without thinking about it day in and day out. And it's not all that easy to turn this off overnight. And as a matter of fact, we can't stop using energy. What we might be able to do is change the energy infrastructure into one which doesn't produce CO2. But even that is not all that easy. People say there's a risk in relying on negative emissions like direct air capture because it's not proven. But it's also not proven that we have an energy storage system that can live with the intermittency of sunshine and wind, right? And most people are objecting to nuclear energy too. So we don't really have good answers yet, and we need to work on hard to get them. And to me, you need to look at all of these aspects, and you probably need all of the above, because no single part of this has a solution by itself. And I think it's very counterproductive to say we don't want the help of this side because we don't like this particular approach to it. This cannot be a zero-sum game, right? Because if it is a zero-sum game, we have lost.
Well, looking forward with your own work at the University of Arizona Center for Negative Carbon Emissions, what's next?
Well, one of the things I'm working on very hard is direct air capture because I think it's pivotal and central. Right? If you have the ability to pull CO2 back out of the air at an affordable price, then you can do several things. You can take that CO2 and you can dispose of it. So that's the waste disposal aspect. And in that sense, I would argue we are the street sweeper, which takes the CO2, which already littered the atmosphere, and take it back. But we can also close the carbon cycle together with renewable energy and observe that liquid carbon-based fuels are actually extremely good at carrying energy in the transportation sector. And nothing really prevents you from making those from CO2 and water and renewable energy, right? So we could make gasoline or methanol or whatever fuel you choose, provided we have energy, which can split water into hydrogen and oxygen and CO2 into CO and oxygen. And the CO and hydrogen we can convert into fuels. And we know how to do this since the 1920s. And Fischer-Tropsch is just one example. The Fischer-Tropsch process is just one example of how to do that. So we can close the carbon cycle that way, and right now this cannot compete because it's more expensive than taking petroleum. But in a world where you have to bury the CO2 from the petroleum, you may very well find that this option is cheaper. Not to mention, it gives an enormous bonus to or benefit to renewable energy, because these are by nature intermittent, and making fuels out of it can be a flexible consumer, right? You can turn it on whenever there is too much electricity and turn it off when there is not enough. And by the way, if there is really not enough, you can consume some of that fuel to make the electricity which is needed right here and now. So a classic example is Denmark, which is relying more and more on wind, and it more and more needs an energy storage system that can take some of the energy when there is lots of wind and it can sell that in principle into the transportation sector where you use fuel. So in this case, we are not trying to create negative emissions, but closing the carbon cycle. But if you think of this problem as a waste management problem, in the parlance of waste management, this is reduce, reuse, recycle, right? We just figured out how to be more efficient. We got away from using fossil carbon, and we recycled the carbon through the system over and over and over again. But whenever you dump CO2 into the atmosphere, you are obligated to take it back out. And right now, I don't really know how to fly an airplane without producing CO2.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Oh, we talked so animatedly, I'm not entirely sure. Let me think about it. I did talk about the waste management analogy. I did talk about a certificate of carbon sequestration. I think ultimately we have proven that it's very, very hard to come up with a top-down solution. So I'm getting more and more to the point where I think it has to be from the bottom up. So imagine a world where you can push a button on the pump where you get your gasoline and you ask for the CO2 you just create to be taken back. Most people don't realize it, but every gallon of gasoline you burn in your car puts 20 pounds of CO2 into the atmosphere. So if you get the price of air capture down to, let's say, $30 a ton, you would have to spend a quarter or more on the gallon of gasoline, and you would have balanced your book. That is also the additional cost if the fuel was made from renewable energy, plus the electricity cost which went into it. It's not the air capture cost, ultimately, which gets you. Now, can we get to $30 a ton? It's very hard to say. At the first time around, people did it with a brute force approach. They were at $600 a ton, so this would add a little more than $5 to the gallon of gasoline, and that clearly feels too expensive. And people back then said, this is hopeless. But on the other hand, photovoltaic today is 100 times cheaper than it was in the 1960s. So once you start working down this learning curve, things will get cheaper. And if you look at the startups, carbon engineering, global thermostat, the technologies we do here in a university environment, we are clearly a lot cheaper than this first one because we all have a much simpler process. Right? So we all think we are on probably between $100 and $200 a ton, and one of them in the group, Global Thermostat, actually thinks they're even well below that, around $50 a ton. But the proof is in the pudding, right? But that means you need somebody who actually takes it off on the other side. And so you need volunteers who help you start.
We've been talking with Dr. Klaus Lackner, a leading scientist in the search for a way to rebalance greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And I'll put links to the papers we've discussed, including Dr. Lackner's letter to the journal Science, as published on November 11th. I'll put all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Klaus Lackner, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time and your insight with us.
You're very welcome. And as you put it up there, please notice there are 44 other people signing the letter.
I will do that, and I'll put that in my blog as well. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.